Locke bids Kate adieu, Hurley gets a free meal out of Sawyer, and Juliet declares, "The shield is down." Executive producers Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse are here to discuss those key points and much more in today's official Lost podcast, hosted by ABC.com. Welcome to the podcast for the episode One of Us. As mentioned, we have our favorite pod squad in the house today. They'll rehash Kate and Juliet's little trust exercise, and of course, they'll give us a sneak peek at our next episode, which airs Wednesday, April 11th, from 10 to 11 p.m. on ABC, and is available the next day at abc.com. First up, though, we hear about a three-hour tour gone wrong. Josh Holloway recounts for us a boating expedition he and Daniel Day-Kim took, and why Daniel will never go out to sea with him again. Okay, so a few weeks ago, we were interviewing Daniel Day-Kim about what he likes to do during his downtime. During that interview, he let it slip that Josh had a bit of a tale to tell us.
Is there anything that you guys do for fun off-camera? Like, are there any bands or any books or any magazines that, you know, you guys have passed around that everyone's like, oh my god, you have to listen to the CD?
Right. Actually, Dom has been instrumental, no pun intended, and helping my musical tastes this year. Because, you know, in Hawaii, it's hard to find, you know, music and my usual avenues are gone to me. So he's recommended a few bands that I've ended up loving this year, and that's been great. Josh and I have many misadventures on his fishing boat, trying to catch fish. And I'll let you ask him about that.
So of course, like any good investigative reporter, we decided to follow Daniel's advice and went straight to Josh.
Daniel Day-Kim was in here and he mentioned that you've been taking him out fishing and getting in.
Yeah, I would be hard-pressed to get Dan on the boat again. I took him out. I was really, the weather's pretty rough in Hawaii. That channel you cross is extremely volatile, and I hadn't been able to fish for a while because of the weather, so I was itching to fish this day. I was like, I'm fishing. I don't care what the weather is. So I watched and watched, and they lifted the small craft advisory that morning. So I was like, okay, we can go. So I have Dan over at 5 in the morning.
And just to pause for a second here, Daniel Day-Kim does have sea legs. We asked him.
Well, how about, like, last year you spoke a little bit about, like, the being on the ocean, like, it was kind of sickening. Was it a little bit better for you this time on the ocean?
Actually, yeah. I guess people call it their sea legs. Mine have gotten a lot stronger, and I actually enjoyed being out on the water.
So with that in mind, back to our story.
By the time we're a mile out, we're soaking wet, head to toe, like, people throwing 5-gallon buckets of water at you about every 10 seconds. And I'm like, it's fine. Drink it. Shake the water out of your eyes and keep going. So we go across the channel, and about the time I hit what we call the Penguin Banks, about 15 miles out, a local guy called me and was like, I hope you're not on the banks, man. And I just arrived. I was like, yeah, it's a little rough out here. So me and Dan fished out with the waves another to 20-something miles. And then we turned around to kind of fish the line back, and we couldn't even stay on the line. It was too big. So it was, there was a lot of silent moments on the boat. And I was trying to instill confidence in Dan by being, it's all right, this is nothing. And I was like, you know, and we were quiet for a good hour. So I don't think he's going to be coming out anytime soon. Don't blame him.
Unfortunately, unlike a good investigative reporter, we didn't get any more details out of Daniel. So instead, we went back to our original question. What favorite band did Dominic recommend?
The honorary title. A New York band Dom turned me onto, and they're melodic. Their songs have a lot of New York references, which, you know, makes me a little homesick. And they're just a great band to listen to when you're driving to work.
I guess when all is said and done, Daniel really isn't that much like his son-of-a-fisherman character. He's just a New York boy at heart. Speaking of work, executive producers Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse take a break from their work on the season finale so that none of us feel left behind.
Welcome to the Lost Podcast. I'm Carlton Cuse, and with me, Damon Lindelof.
Is that your NPR voice?
That's my movie trailer voice.
It's good.
For when this show's over and I can have a real career.
You have to say something like, Jack Shepherd was a doctor like any other doctor until
he went to the mysterious island.
Oh, I was doing the comedy version, yes. Which is like, you know, the more like
Jack Shepherd was a simple doctor fixing people's spines in L.A. Then suddenly, in a wacky fashion, he ended up on a mysterious island.
That's great. I'd watch that movie. But they'd have to put a question mark at the end of the Lost there. It'd be Lost.
Damon, talk about Locke. Why is he off there with the others? What kind of case did Locke make for Kate?
Wow,
who writes this stuff? I mean, Chris, could you write this at least like so that it like sounds conversational?
I don't know what happened with Eddie and Adam last week, but you've taken a massive step backwards in your podcasting abilities. I think, you know.
I love Eddie and Adam, but it just wasn't the same.
The last time we left, you were doing these questions. You were actually making it conversational again, and now you're back on script. And when you read a sentence like, what kind of case did Locke make for Kate? You know, it's kind of hard to understand what the hell that means. Because I believe it's referring to Locke says to Kate, hey, I tried to make a case for you, but they wanted to leave you behind anyway.
Was it a Prada case?
I don't know what kind of case it was. Could have been a guitar case. Could have been any kind of case. A hat case?
I'm just saying I'm not happy with the question. I'm not happy with the way it was written.
I guess the operative question here is, when are we going to see John Locke again? I mean, you know, literally
for a while.
I'm just telling you.
You
make
Damon.
This big stink. He blows up a sub. He sees his father.
He's all wet.
Bound and gagged. He's soaking wet, walking down the dock. And now he says goodbye to Kate, and you're telling me I have to wait? You give me Nikki and Paolo?
Nikki and Paolo. Absolutely. They're a lot more interesting than John Locke, aren't they?
I guess so. So how much longer are we talking before we see John Locke again?
5 weeks.
5 weeks from right now?
Pretty much.
It's more like 4 weeks, right?
I'll see 4 weeks.
He'll pop back up in the episode
19. I have no idea when you're listening to this podcast, but it's episode 19.
You've now seen episode 15. Right. So,
okay, so
16 said you have to see 3 more episodes before John Locke reappears.
Don't be doing all this math on my head.
I won't. Yo.
Okay, it's episode 19.
Okay.
Locke, he's back.
That's good.
How much does Juliet really know about the smoke monster, Damon?
Well, that's an interesting question, Carlton. And I guess that she tells Kate as they're hiding in the tree that she's never seen it before and she's acting very scared. But it seems like Juliet is able to act in many ways that are quasi-duplicitous or not entirely honest. Because she certainly knows how to repel the smoke monster.
Right.
So that would lead her, and then after she does, she goes, okay, I've seen it before, but we don't know what it is. So I wouldn't exactly take her at her word there either.
Can I ask you something else?
Yes, you may.
What is the difference between being duplicitous and being quasi-duplicitous?
Well, being duplicitous is out and out lying, and being quasi-duplicitous is sort of fudging the truth. Like when I told you this morning that you look nice. That would be quasi-duplicitous.
I thought that was just duplicitous.
Well, because you look okay, but you don't look nice.
This definitely didn't happen with Eddie and Adam. Let me just say that.
That's because you can fire Eddie and Adam.
And they wore their pants.
Wow, they wore their pants?
They wore their pants. It was a very odd experience to actually do the podcast in those circumstances.
So I'm a little curious here about Juliet getting left behind. I mean, what's up with that? Like, why do you think Ben ditched her?
I think that, you know, maybe there's kind of two possible explanations. One is he was tired of Juliet, didn't want her around anymore. Or maybe there's some other reason why he left her behind.
Interesting. I'll stay tuned to find out what reason B could potentially
be. That's possibly interesting.
And maybe there's something personal between the two of them that, you know, he pissed her off. She pissed him off. Or
clearly there is. I mean, clearly there's some unresolved tension there. Maybe we'll find out about that sometime.
You know what I'd love to see? Another Juliet flashback, because I was at the end of the last one after they essentially hit her husband with a bus. I'd love to know what happened when she came to the island.
Well, that's a pretty good lead-in to a rehash of One of Us.
Oh, my God.
Because strangely and surprisingly, that actually is a Juliet flashback.
Do you see how it's done now, Carlton? How one looks at the sheet that Chris prepares and then creates flow?
It is astonishing how you can read so well.
It's one of my greatest skills.
It is. It is amazing. I would never sell it short.
Thank you. So let's talk about One of Us.
I like One of Us. I think it's really one of our better episodes this season. And it does give us that next missing piece in that Juliet flashback story. It kind of tells us what happens after, you know, the scene we saw previously when Alpert recruited her. And now we get to find out what happens.
And Alpert is the guy who was the Middelos Bioscience representative.
The man showing her the slides and telling her what a great place Portland was. Although, my guess is they're probably not really going to Portland because the episode was called Not in Portland.
But maybe we were just trying to deceive the audience, and in fact the entire show takes place in an island off the coast of Portland.
That is possible. That's true. How does Portland compare to Tallahassee?
I would say if Tallahassee were a 1, Portland would be a 4.
A 4?
On a scale of 1 to 5.
Oh, on a scale of 1 to 5.
Right.
Oh, okay.
Although Tallahassee is also a 1 on a scale of 1 to 20.
I thought it was going to be a 1 to 10 scale, but okay.
I love Tallahassee. I want to visit Tallahassee, and I'm sorry that we're giving Tallahassee
to
you don't
want to go
rap.
To Tallahassee because
I
if
do.
You go down there, you're going to get lynched.
I would. I'm public enemy number 1. Honestly, Tallahassee is a fantastic. Why are you shaking your head, Carl?
I love Tallahassee.
All right. Well, okay. I think we should probably
let's move on to some questions here.
Let's get to some questions.
All right, I'm going to start. Okay.
Would you?
Hey, how about that question music, Chris?
So catchy.
Okay. Cameras used for filming Lost. This is a good question because you are very technically oriented. By the failed Hanzo experiment, one post in the last 90 days. Hey guys, I have a question suggestion for you guys. I noticed while watching season 3. That the look of the show is less cinematic than seasons 1 and 2. I was wondering if this is due to new filming equipment used on the set of Lost, or is it something else? I suggest you guys go back to using the same type of cameras and used in the filming of seasons 1 and 2.
That is a great suggestion. I think we should.
Okay.
I mean,
we will.
That's a great note. We've been shooting the show on Betamax this year.
It was. There's got to be an effort to save money someplace.
Sometimes you cost corner.
You
cut corners.
I guess all that reading is taken away from your talking.
My ability to speak. Sometimes we cut corners to in turn cut costs, and that's why we started shooting the show on beta this year. So we'll go back to film.
35mm Panavision.
Who wrote that?
The failed Hanzo experiment.
Failed Hanzo experiment. You've just won an HD television courtesy of Jeffrey Fortas at ABC Publicity. Please send him a letter.
He's now putting a gun to his head.
Anybody who watches the show on high def would never doubt the cinematic quality.
There's no free TVs.
Well, I don't know.
No free TV.
Carlton, I've got a question for you.
Yes, Damon.
By insert creative name here. 2 posts in the last 90 days.
That.
Immediately I said, whatever this question is, I'm reading it.
Yeah.
Damon and Carlton, when you do a flashback scene such as the fuselage crash on the beach in Exposé, do you completely reshoot the scene with the old props and actors, use some fancy technology to drop in the characters and events that pertain to that episode's backstory, or not have to reshoot because you already shot footage for every possible backstory you guys had thought of at the time because you're omniscient super geniuses? Impressed either way, insert creative name here.
Well, obviously it's C.
Right.
It's the latter. We shot everyone's backstories all simultaneously.
Yeah, when we were down there shooting the pilot, JJ was like, you know, we had cast Paolo and Nikki already, and everyone was like, why are we shooting this? And we were like,
wait
and see.
You'll know 50 episodes from
now. All make sense later.
Actually, the real answer is B. We took the actors and we, through a very complex green screen process, not very complex, through a green screen process, we stuck them into the old footage to make them appear as though they were there during the crash of the plane.
And also a little bit of A, too. I mean, we kind
of
restaged like some
stuff,
pieces of flaming. This is actually a funny story. Gene Higgins, who is our line producer... amazing, responsible for everything that sort of you see on screen, along with Jack Bender down in Hawaii, has been calling us for the better part of 2 years now, saying, "Can I throw the fuselage away?"
We're like, "Nope,
no, hold on to it." She goes, "But they left the beach, you know. They're now, the fuselage is in it. We'll never know when we'll need it again." And fortunately, when Exposé came along, there it was.
Exactly.
Gene's kind of like my mom when I was like 10 years old. She'd come into my room and be like, "Do you want to throw this away?" And I'd be like, "No, I need that." She'd be like, "What for? When's the last time you used it?" And I'd be like, "I don't know, but I need it." And that's kind of the same relationship now that we have with Gene.
Okay, Damon, I got a question for you, buddy.
Go for it, Carlton.
Any chance we'll see Libby again this season? I miss her, and it seems like there's so much more backstory to tell with her, all the mysteries surrounding the mental institution and giving Desmond her boat.
Do you think mental institutions are funny?
No, but I'm just thinking, like, how much mystery is there surrounding giving Desmond her boat? I mean, we sort of explained. They sat down, they had coffee. She said, "Take the boat." Do we need to see... Although a flashback where she actually signs the deed of title could be very exciting.
She did make a reference to the fact that her husband had died, though, and maybe there's some sort of kind of story to tell there. Yeah. I would say that you certainly haven't seen the last of Libby. We miss her, too. One of the things that, you know, people always ask us, have you made mistakes on the show, or do you have regrets about the show? One of those regrets is that we weren't really able to service Cynthia Watros as an actress better in season two, obviously. There was a lot of grumbling about, as there was this year, that we weren't giving our regulars enough screen time. And with Mr. Echo and Ana Lucia sort of joining, you know, the cast of characters, Libby sort of got short shrift. So we owe those answers, and we have every hope that Cynthia is going to come back and come back to the show and, you know, grace us with her presence again so we can answer them.
Well spoken.
I haven't even read this question yet. Again, I just saw the subject heading and I checked it off. So, this is by Found Damon Panties. 3 posts in the last 90 days. So that's good.
Okay.
I'm glad that you found my panties. And if you will send them to Jeffrey Fortas at ABC, he will be sure to give them back to you. Dear Carlton Beavis and Damon Butthead. Firstly, the usual. Love the show. You guys do a great job. Shout outs to the cast, the creative team, staff, etc. Best show on earth ever. But something is bugging me since last Wednesday after watching Exposé. Paolo and Nikki are reading a newspaper waiting for the Flight 815 with the date of Thursday, September 24th, 2004. Which, by the way, according to the Gregorian calendar, was a Friday. But we learned before that the flight departed September 22nd, a Wednesday. So what happened? I hope that was not a prop error. Otherwise, I would have to believe the people which made that were voting for Sanjaya while doing the work and getting distracted with it. All the best. Keep up the great work. Peace. So how do we explain that, Carlton?
I can't.
Are you going to fire someone now?
I think I'm going to be leaving now to go fire someone.
Found Damon Panty. Congratulations. You just got someone fired.
The important part of that is that you found Damon's panties. That's really the most significant thing.
I'm pretty sure it was the 22nd, which is the day that the premiere actually aired.
Now, you've got the international dateline. That's a problem, too.
Oh, yeah, that's right. It's Australia, which
it's
is Australia, a day ahead.
So that's a day ahead.
And it could have been the late edition, which would have been the next day's paper.
So there, maybe it actually all makes sense.
So we just save someone's
job. There's a guy named Greg Nations who keeps all of our timelines, and we're going to go have a little come-to-Jesus meeting with him as soon as this podcast is over.
I guarantee you, though, the prop department called Greg and said, what should the date on the paper be? And Greg said, it should be September 24th.
Right. So he's got some way to explain that. I don't know how.
He'll come in and explain it for you.
Yes, he will. He'll come in.
Wearing my panties.
We'll do that in some other podcast.
Fantastic.
Sometime in the distant future. How many producers to screw in a light bulb, Damon, by Jody Loves Lost?
Wait, can I get... the answer is 3. Now you can ask the question.
Why?
Because you said how many...
Okay, yeah. No, this is usually a joke. It's like, you know, how many Teamsters does it take to screw in a light bulb, you know?
You better not tell that joke. I know how many Jewish...
10. You got a problem with that?
Yeah, that's good.
Damon and Carlton, I've been rewatching seasons 1 and 2 of Lost lately, and I'm amazed watching the credits to see how many producers there are. Just curious, what's the difference between a producer, an executive producer, a supervising producer, a co-executive producer, a co-producer, and an associate producer? And why, Damon and Carlton, are you the ones to do the podcast? Are the other producers not as entertaining? Or did you guys just draw the wrong straws? And have you noticed that if you look at the word producer enough, it starts to look like it's spelled funny? Thanks. Love the show more than ever.
Who's this from?
Jody Loves Lost.
Okay, first off, Jody, It's time to get back on the meds. Second, if the word producer, if you're staring at it for too long, seriously, just don't stare at it. Secondly, all of those fancy titles are basically just that. They are titles. So, you know, you basically start in the business, if you are a writer, as a staff writer, and then you move up to story editor, then executive story editor, then co-producer, then you're officially a producer, then you go supervising producer, co-executive producer, and finally executive producer, which is the top of the proverbial food chain.
There's the complications, like you can also, there's often credits produced by, because there's a producer who's actually in charge of the physical production, and that person is actually a producer, whereas in some cases the people with these producer titles are writers. So that is the hierarchy for writers, and as you ascend, you get a producer title that goes with your writing skills and talents, and you're involved actually in helping to produce the episodes.
They're like belts in karate.
They are, exactly. Or military titles.
Sure, yeah. But also you don't have to be a writer. Like Jack Bender is an executive producer on the show, and he runs the show in Hawaii. So.
Yeah, so he's a director, and Stephen Williams is a supervising producer, and he's also a director. Gene Higgins is in charge of physical production, and she's a co-executive producer, and Pat Churchill is a producer, and she is also works on the physical production side. All the other people that have producer credits are writers. And so that, so because there are so many producers, I mean, first of all, this is
now,
probably logistically...
Now they've got a point, though, because the more you say the word producer, the more strange it sounds.
Exactly. Jody's right. Anyway, so there is it's such a logistically challenging show that we actually have, I think, 14 people that have a producer or above title on the show. But I can't imagine that there's any other scripted series that's as complicated to produce as Lost in the known universe.
And how go your negotiations to become a mega producer on the show, Carlton? How's that working out?
Senior supervising. Emperor producer.
Emperor is nice.
An emperor producer. Title. That's good.
Got a nice ring to it.
Okay. Well, there you have it. That's all we can say on that subject.
And it's not a lot. I hope you watered your plants while we were doing our dissertation on producing.
One more question?
Sure, Carlton. I don't have any more, so if you've got one more for me.
Hello, amigos. Greetings from Brazil. I've got some questions for you. Number one, were you guys talking serious about Rousseau having a flashback? She seems to know a lot about what's happened on the island. There's three of these, so you don't have to ponder them too much.
One, yes, Rousseau will eventually have a flashback, but I would actually argue that considering she's been there for 16 years, Rousseau knows strikingly little about the island. I'm always fascinated by how she spends her time, I guess, just eating bugs and hanging out and reciting poetry to herself. Because every time, our characters have only been there for about 80 days, and every time Rousseau sees something, she goes, I've never seen this before.
That's
so
awesome.
There you go.
Number two, will we learn more about the De Groots in the third or fourth season? By the way, that Karen chick is hot.
Yes, and we concur.
And number three, is it true that the show Don't Make Me Play This Banjo is already in pre-production?
I hope so. They haven't reached out to... Carlton is obviously the star of that show. I'm just the sort of plucky comic relief, but... It is in pre-production, I would hope, and it'll
You're
be
sort
on
of my
right
Timberlake at... producer yeah. for that show, aren't
That's
you?
That's cool. Yeah, I am. I just kind of sit there. And
all right, guys. Thanks so much, and we're out of here.
See you next week.
See you next week for another edition of the Lost Podcast.
That's it for this podcast. Join us again next week for a friendly chat with Mr. Friendly, actor MC Gainey. We'll discuss what it's like playing a longtime baddie and the first time you met Carlton Cuse on a little cult hit called The Adventures of Briscoe County Jr. One of Us airs Wednesday, April 11th from 10 to 11 p.m. on ABC and the next day at abc.com.